Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 93. Yes, David's joining me for the podcast intro. Hi, David. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not too bad.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to have you.
I'm glad that you're having me be on here.
That's awesome. Well, so the guests on this podcast are Steve Spaz Williams. Everyone knows him as Spaz, but call him Steve as well.
S-Paz.
Yeah. And Mark DePay, who are both ex-ILM guys. And they were kind of like the original gangsters of CG and
at
ILM.
Yeah.
These guys are amazing. Yeah. So tell them some of the things that they have done, David.
They have done The Water Weenie.
Yes. From The Abyss.
The Abyss.
Yep.
Jurassic Park.
Yeah. They did the original test that showed that they could do a CG dinosaur and that ended up taking work away from Phil Tippett.
Wow. That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's a very controversial thing, but they basically did that.
T2.
Yeah. They work with Cameron again on T2 and they talk about how they came up with, the whole walk cycle. You know, the thing is amazing to me. I mean, do you remember T2, obviously.
That
pinnacle shot where he's walking out of the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always looked at that shot and the way he walks out of it, he looks very robotic, right? And it's like, I did just think, well, the character animation back then was not, very good or whatever. Well, I saw the original footage that they rotomotioned.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly the way he walked.
Oh, really?
He walked like a robot.
Wow.
Because that was the thing. Right,
right, right.
And
right.
It was perfect. So it was really kind of amazing to see those guys. Those guys are great.
Crazy thing about T2, by the way.
Yeah.
When it was being promoted here, and
yes.
There are trailers everywhere.
Yes.
I was in England at the time.
Okay.
So when I came back to the States and saw the movie, I did not know that Arnold was a good guy.
Oh.
And so I was like really worried and wanting the cop to get to the kid. Like
right.
The trailer's just completely, like that was a whole element of suspense that I was experiencing in the theater.
That's awesome.
That people just
right.
had already learned of.
Wow. That's amazing. That's actually really good. Must have been an incredible experience then to see it like that.
Yeah, because Arnold in Terminator is not good.
No, he's not a good person.
Not good at all.
Nope, not at all.
Yeah.
Well, it was really cool to talk to those guys. They're really funny. The two of them are clearly more than best friends. They just talk to each other, talk over each other like an old married couple. I mean, they're really just really, really fun to hang out with them. This is part of my THU stuff. I saw them at THU. And I want to mention one of the promos we're doing is with THU TV. So if you get THU TV, and I mentioned it a couple other podcasts, but I'll remind people, just look up THU TV on Google. It's an easy way to do it. Or you can, if you want the direct link, it's trojan-unicorn.com/TV. And you can get THU TV, which is really great. And you can see Mark and Steve's and Spaz's talk that was on THU TV. But if you use the promo code CG Garage, you'll get a 20% discount.
Look at that.
20% discount.
That's not bad. Yeah. I had no idea we were throwing out promo codes for things.
Yeah, like a real podcast.
sponsored by.
That's right. Yeah, next we'll do mattresses, right?
That's right. Yes. Sleep train.
Sleep train.
Your ticket to a better night's sleep.
Yeah. No, but this is something that's important to me because, I'm a ridiculous fanboy and cult leader, or not leader, but person.
Cult leader.
Of THU. I think it's a really important event, and I love it, and I want to help Andre, and I think that this is a great way to sort of promote that. And THU TV is really great content. Right now, I think they have basically just the talks themselves, but he's going to release a whole bunch of new content and newly edited talks. So it's going to be a lot of stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks. So you can buy it now and you'll get the content later, or you can wait a couple of weeks. But remember that there's only 100 codes that they're taking. So hurry up and get it now.
Oh, all right.
And hopefully. You can get it. All right. So that's it. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
I have an update for you, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just so everyone knows, we have an update coming out for V-Ray for Modo. to support Moto 10.2.
Oh, really? Okay. Yes. There you go. So V-Ray for Moto update. Oh, yeah. Yes. And there is something else we forgot to mention. V-Ray Days Italy Roadshow, right?
Yeah.
Starting October 25th to November 5th. We're going to be in like Rome and Florence and Milan and Venice and I forgot where else. But go check out chaoscoop.com/events and you can check out V-Ray Days Italy Tour.
Cool? That sounds good.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So it's just free flow.
Just keep it going.
Just keep it going. It was a great talk today. Really loved it.
Thank you.
One of the things I want to do is I want to try to get some extra stories out of people. And
are you sure?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, because of THUTV, I don't necessarily want to for you to repeat what you guys said, then they can just go watch it on THUTV. But I think there's some really other questions that I had about it, which are really cool. So I want to find out a little bit about your background before you got into any of this or ILM or anything. And you kind of hinted at it a little bit. You guys both come from very different backgrounds, right? You did some military stuff over at Alias, and you were teaching over at Berkeley. Is that right?
Yeah, he was raised as a wolf child. That's the major difference.
Yeah.
Raised by wolves.
Raised by wolves,
yeah.
Eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was, I got interested in doing a sort of experimental film and using technology to do imagery, and I studied, I met some people that were doing sort of experiments with video and computer processing.
Not experiment.
Yeah. yes, well, yeah. But in any event, so I got, and I learned and ran into some of the very earliest computer graphics. I actually worked with this group that did the first computer painting system and did things like imagery involved with dancers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I learned about computer graphics, and I was very interested in film at the time, even though I hadn't done much real filmmaking, just right. Experimental abstract stuff. And at the same time, George Lucas started his digital film group.
Okay.
And I went to Berkeley to study computer graphics in the computer science department. And actually, Ed Catmull was one of the visiting professors there.
Oh,
and
right.
At that time. And I was very focused on doing computer graphics because I was really a believer in this fundamental possibility that was new and that really attracted me. And the technology was evolving a lot. And so I got, so that was happening. And we brought, a professor was brought in to be our formal professor because Ed was just a visiting faculty member at the time.
Okay.
And we developed, got all this fancy new hardware, was using access to supercomputers that were funded by the government. It was the beginning of the internet. It was called the ARPANET at the time.
Mm-hmm. What was it called?
ARPANET.
Hmm.
ARPA is an Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is part of the Defense Department.
Right.
And I would do stuff like they would have some Cray computer at Livermore Labs doing atomic bomb experiments, and all I want to do is simulate glass balls or something silly like that.
Yep.
And that was really complicated at that time.
Uh-huh.
And we would call up, and they would clear the computer, and I would be able to upload my program and run it for like 20 minutes. It'd be worth that expense was outrageous, mm-hmm. and I get the results back, and we play them back on this. We had a Iconus film buffer, I remember, frame buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all sophisticated stuff. We had guys, some of my classmates were rewriting Unix at the time. They called it BSD.
Yeah.
And so we would actually have special drivers made to allow us to access this gear on a big VAX computer. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this all basically was this high-tech world, very sophisticated technology and software, and I was experimenting with a very early...
Experimenting
with, you can say that word for me, with sort of photoreal imaging at that time. And so I was really into doing this. I guess I would really call it like my interest was in this sort of idea of making pictures and images that were unlike what you could see today. That
yeah.
was sort of it. And technology was the way in which we could do it.
Uh-huh.
And I did a lot of work in that regard. And then the Abyss came along. And people at ILM I knew. And it was a sort of, how could we do it? Who can do it? And I was given the opportunity to help bring the water weenie to life. And basically, I had been working in exactly that kind of thing, in
right.
a sort of theoretical way, you might call it.
Yeah, but what year was it you wrote that paper on stochastic ray tracing?
Yeah.
So was that 82? Was it 85?
In the 80s, and I wrote some stuff about things like parallel computing. I mean, I did these academic things. I got a PhD in computer graphics.
Right.
And actually the first one at Berkeley. Because,
oh, okay.
Because at that time, computer graphics wasn't even a bona fide area of academic research.
Right, right.
And so I had to petition, and I think Ed and some other people, Frank Crow was another guy, and then my main professor, Brian Barsky, who was brought to Berkeley to support the idea of a computer graphics research group.
Right.
And we had to petition and get them to agree that it was worthy of, you know, because Berkeley is an impressive.
And was this around the same time as what Albie Ray was doing?
Oh, yeah. All those guys were doing their same thing independently.
Right.
And they were the Lucasfilm digital film group. So they were some of my inspirations. Guys Ed and Jim Blinn. And
right.
They were before me. And so I was the generation, standing on their shoulders that was able to apply their ideas to use in live action filmmaking.
Right. And the water weaning was huge to me. I remember that. And so you, I love the story that you told where you like, you guys, you walked into ILM and you're like, that was my first album I ever bought. And you said the same thing, right? Yeah, which album was it, by the way, so do people know?
Alice Cooper, Love It to Death. I'm 18.
You know what's funny?
I'm 18 was playing.
We're very different, but we have strange similarities.
Yeah.
Things like that. And I grew up in Alaska, you grew up in Canada. So there's a certain kind of like living in the woods, know how to use a chainsaw kind of thing.
Yeah.
Even though we're different, we have a lot of similarities.
And,
guns and blah, blah. You go speak.
So, all right. So that's a very cool background. And yours is so different. It's just kind of interesting as well. So
I was lucky. I was, ended up at the right place at the right time, I guess.
But what?
So I started with the U.S. or Canadian military.
Right.
And then from there, I was a shooter, scout sniper, right?
Uh-huh.
I was a shooter.
And the Canadian snipers are kind of famous for some of
they
the, are. The best
they
in the world.
They hold the longest record in the world right,
right
now.
Right.
Rob Furlong, a Newfie, right? 2650.
Wow.
Yeah, 1.5 miles.
Yeah.
Using a McMillan Brothers TAC 50.
Okay.
With a MST, US Optics MST 100 scope. Yeah. Anyhow, so I got scouted by the British Royal Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
So I was there in the Falklands in 82.
Okay.
So when I came back to Canada, they had a very similar situation, like the Americans, where they give you money to go to school.
Oh, cool.
So I went to University of Toronto for a year for engineering.
That's where you're from, right?
I'm from Toronto.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I'm from Toronto. And that didn't really work out. And then so I went to Sheridan College and took animation. I was always an animation fan.
Okay.
So I took hand-drawn classical animation.
Right.
Did 3 years of that.
Yeah, I saw on your presentation you gave some great, great classic cartoon examples that inspired you.
I purposely throw those in.
Right.
It's because there's a relativity about it, Mm-hmm. When I say, in the talk I say, does anyone know what year this is, right? And who was watching it on TV? No one was watching because cartoons were not transferred for television back then.
Right.
They're black and white NTSC.
Right.
Then, one thing led to the next. I ended up at Alias Research.
Okay.
They opened their doors in 86,
Right.
And became a hotshot modeling. And so they kind of sent me all over the world. And then I quit Alias because I was getting all this freelance work. And I ended up at the Analytic Sciences Corporation, which is a weapons manufacturer in Reading, Massachusetts.
Okay.
It was a special naval warfare shop, right?
Okay.
So one day, I was there for 9 months or something, and my XO comes in, and this is September of 88.
Okay.
And he goes, there is a company, I think I told it, in Marin County, California, working on a special naval film.
Right.
And they want to know if anyone understands about fluid dynamics.
Uh-huh.
And I was working on the fluorocarbon cool system of the SeaWiz, what they call the Phalanx, which is a Clausen's weapon system.
Okay.
It was a Gatling gun, essentially.
Right.
It looked like R2-D2. It had the dome with the Gatling gun at the front of it. So I said, sure, I'll go. And the film was The Abyss.
Right.
So I walk into the pit. I see this hippie right there. So I walk in all jar-headed out and everything. And he has his feet in the desk, and he's got Alice Cooper, Love It to Death playing, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm 18. And that's exactly what I said. I said, this is the first album I ever bought. And he goes, it's the first album I ever bought. And that was it.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's where it started. And we had certain policies in our office about just complete, we were always questioning established systems because it was a very stuffy company. So I think almost instantaneously we had a huge fucking party,
right,
know, in the pit. Uh-huh. And we would hang posters all over. And Mark titled it An Evening of Social Penetration.
The title was nailed.
Nailed.
Nailed. Social Penetration. And we had another saying, which was, alcohol is social lubrication. Get ready to get oily.
So we had a big bowl of martinis, and the olives were at the bottom. Uh-huh. We gave everyone a glass, and you had to dunk your glass in.
Wow. Right?
And it was like a pitcher of martinis.
Wow.
The garbage can.
And then the funniest thing in the world is that we had a supervisor. He's a really nice guy, Doug Kay. Uh-huh. He's a great guy. And he ran the CG department. Uh-huh. So he actually came in, and he was kind of flipped out. We were having a party anyways.
Right.
So when he comes down and he goes, okay, I've checked with the powers that be.
Yeah.
It's okay to have a party, but no drugs. Yeah. And we're there with Wes Takahashi.
Yeah, I got to mention old Wes.
Yeah. So, I mean, but the thing is that we were working really, really long hours.
Right.
And we knew we were working on stuff that no one really understood.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing that got me about ILM back then is that because I had been doing enough freelance stuff, you know, just getting a freelance gig to build data, you know, mm-hmm. and no one really knew about B-spline data back then, you know.
Right.
And, but the thing that blew me away is that they had so much money, right? Like I remember John Knoll originally was mm-hmm. our supervisor on the sure. thing. And John didn't really understand about computer graphics at all. I mean, I distinctly remember being in a meeting, uh-huh. right, where Mark is attempting to explain the process of rendering to Knoll. Happened.
Okay.
Yes. I'm probably getting in trouble for it. I don't fucking care. He's yeah. a chief creative officer now. Anyways, I remember, so Knoll had come in, and I was at the first shot I animated for The Abyss was FX-142. It's the one where the pod's lifting up and right. looking at, you know. And that was the first shot that I had done, and I animated, and Mark did the code for it.
Right.
And I remember Knoll come in, and he goes, well, change this. And he wasn't an animator at all, mm-hmm. right? And he came from the optical side. He ran the optical printer. Mm-hmm. And I remember, as I said, what blew me away is that ILM had so much money, right? Mm-hmm. They could go to 30, 40 takes, right? So at take 30, okay, which is like a week later, 2 weeks later, which it blew my mind because I thought, well, you're supposed to get a take out fast, right? Mm-hmm. But they didn't care, you know? So what I did was is that, and I could tell he was flailing a little bit with his supervision ideas. Mm-hmm. So what I purposely did is that I took take one mm-hmm. and I had it 2 weeks later, right?
As take
and
he goes, fine. 31, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that happened.
Yeah.
And we were more rebellious, but there was more of a system there that we kind of rebelled against. So we knew that if we rebelled against a system, they're going to have new types of films.
Right.
You know,
I mean, just to add something is, you know, my background was at that point extremely, you know, deep and technical, and there mm-hmm. weren't people like that. I mean, I just received a PhD in
right.
computer graphics, so it's
so you were kind of like a live TD, kind of what they would call it.
Yeah, like yeah. a super like TD,
original TD.
Yeah, yeah. And in those days, we were inventing all this stuff too, mm-hmm. and it happened to be that I was I'd been exploring those exact techniques. Like, I don't know if we talked about it today at all in our through talk, but so for example, RenderMan was a new piece of software and I began, and I understand the ideas of shading and lighting, you know, relatively deeply for that day. I mean, now it's all seems so standard, but really at that time we were pushing what the software could do. I mean, RenderMan, we broke it. We found limitations and bugs because we were actually doing quite sophisticated things given the state of the art. Mm-hmm. And part of that would be stuff like doing one level of ray tracing within our shaders.
Right.
Stuff like that. And those ideas, you know, I was familiar with, but really, you know, not many people were. And certainly most of the group there didn't have the same background.
Right.
But, you know, and so that was a big opportunity, mm-hmm. you know, and also allowed someone like myself to, you know, do all these, perform all these miracles, so to speak. But really right. it was just, in a lot of sense too, Steve too, as he mentions, it's this sort of accidentally amazing situation that was created. Mm-hmm. Even your connection to the things you were doing were so strange and complicated, and yet we put it together, it's like magical ingredients, you right. and I both in this situation. So it was fortuitous too.
Right.
But it's also the other thing is that the people that were there, they were nice people and stuff like that, but they were more, like I was the first animator there, right?
Right.
You know, in that department. You know, there was maybe only 10 of us in that whole department. We had two machines, you know. Mm-hmm. And the attitude was more of a technical-based thing, right, as opposed to actually animating character, you know.
Right.
And so I was actually just really fortunate, really lucky enough to actually understand enough about the software and enough about drawing and stuff.
Right.
You know, and running into Mark, who also had – Mark had an attitude, right? And his attitude – we had this, you know, we had this attitude, we can fucking do anything.
Right.
You know, but no one else there had that attitude.
Right.
You know, so Mark kind of legitimized it for me, you know.
Yeah, it is kind of true that the filmmaking has a tradition and there's a system in that, and I, in a way that's what it was, and we were from outside that world, really.
Right.
I mean, I was involved in experimental film things, but it was, just wasn't the same. I mean,
we got suspended three times.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if we can tell those stories.
Yeah.
but yeah, so we really were, and I think also we're free thinkers, and we weren't worried about our place or our position so much. We just were like, wanted to do these things.
Right. But there's guys that are climbing the corporate ladder. There are guys that are climbing that corporate ladder that actually really didn't have very much talent. And I won't mention any names. Right. I think it's fairly obvious.
Yeah.
But they were corporate thinkers, you know, and about their own position. We didn't give a shit, you know. You know, I mean, you know, they wanted us fired during Terminator 2, right? And we said, fine, fire us, go ahead. And, well, James Cameron, fortunately.
Right.
Stuck his foot in and said, you fire them, right? I will yank Terminator 2 from Dust or Light Magic.
Right. Well.
And that happened.
But Scott had your back on that too,
no,
right?
Scott was crazy. Scott, yeah. Important part,
yeah. And Scott was actually a very important component at that time.
Right. Right?
Because he would fight the system, you know.
Right.
And there was a system there, you know. And he was very accommodating to artists. I even have a hard time calling myself an artist. I mean, it's hilarious, really.
Right.
Know, kind of thing. So, but people that were thinking differently, he would accommodate them. And he, I think I said it in the talk, he actually, you know, ponied up a lot of money, right, for the technology that was required. And they were such a wealthy company.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? We didn't like the machine. Boom, it was gone. Got another one. You know,
right.
It didn't matter.
I mean, it's true. Scott, I think, appreciated... You play. You work hard. You play hard. He appreciated that those who are different require some different rules.
Sure.
So even though, you know, like we're like high school vandals or something silly like that.
Well, it was really, pretty similar to DD at the time. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that attitude is something that Scott just sort of let them do what they need to do as long as they get their stuff done. And
it's
kind of
like the rebel attitude. You know, with it, you know, there's no true criminality involved. But the idea that, if you know, can we say any words we want to on the show?
Absolutely.
Okay, you know, it's like, you know, fuck all. You do what you want to do, get the job done.
Sure.
I even experienced that in my grad school days at Berkeley.
Right.
You'd meet these entrepreneurs, man, and they're smart cats, and they've seen a lot, and they say, hey, come do this for me because you're a smart guy, and you go, no, I'm doing this thing. Hey, man. Want money? You're going to fucking be a millionaire in 2 years.
Right.
Cars? What is it? Girls? What is it? Drugs? What is it you need to come work with us?
That's exactly what would happen.
And you just go, this is what I'm doing. And you have this passion. And then they go, okay, cool.
All right.
But it's like you have that attitude that people understand is that creative, whatever, power, genius, specialness, newness, the people that are going to do something that breaks new ground, man, they might not be like everyone else,
right?
And you want to create space for that.
Yeah, you know? yeah, absolutely.
We would do things to push it too, right?
Right. You know,
because we knew the company was stuffy,
and
anybody that we wanted to bring in, you know, DLM at that time, we wanted to make sure they were different, you know, thought differently.
Yeah.
You know, and we ended up with a lot of conservative people. Well, we ended up with a lot of fucking nutcases too,
right.
Which is great.
There were a lot of people that were just with the program, baby. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to wave the nutcase flag or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, even Spaz, you're talking about this idea, it's hard to say you're an artist. It said, in a weird way, there's nothing normal about it. I mean, look, you have a strong artistic streak, but also you like know how to drive a tractor and a forklift and all that kind of crap. There's something about...
All you do is blacksmith now.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly.
For real.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, that's right. His pencils is a semi-automatic, or whatever.
Steel,
so, but the truth is, there's something about this strange combination of individuals and talents and attitudes that just makes something magical. Right. I really think it was a point in time when this confluence of things was, who the fuck knew what was going to happen?
Right, yeah.
And something special did happen.
Yeah.
You know, and you really can't, and I think that sometimes it's like, you know, the brutal hand of conformity, like this is the way it's done. you can get great results, but you know what they're going to be.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So somehow
we get a very predictable outcome.
Yeah. But it can still be fantastic. I mean,
sure.
It has its purpose, but somehow in where we were, there's something about it that we look back at and it's like, it was fucking nuts.
Right.
I mean, in a lot of ways, we would say, like we still say, we can do anything, you know, and we would stand up to a bold, you know, bold faced and like, yeah, we can do that, you know.
Sure.
And then we turn around and go, can we do that?
Yeah.
And there's something about that, that you just want to be having that brashness, which is kind of youth. You know, it's the youth of
there was a lot of youth.
The folly, I mean, of youth.
We're in our 20s.
Sure.
Yeah, we're in our 20s.
But you're in your 20s and you have like a dream job. And yeah. You're doing your yeah. passion.
Yeah. That's a
we
big
couldn't
part
even
of
explain
it.
What we did to people.
No.
No one really knew.
No.
Right? I said you're doing
well, that's never been yeah. seen before.
It's never been seen.
Yeah. Yeah. So even the concept of CG in films have never been seen
yeah,
before.
Yeah. Yeah, very little anyway. And, right. and basically, that's to me really essential to remember. We were smart guys and we could see it. We knew it. And we would say yes, and then you turn around and go, fuck, man, we have to do it.
Yeah.
Because we had never done it.
Right. But that part didn't bother me at all. I you know,
I don't think you have any fear in you at all.
I had no fear. I had no fear at all, right? I didn't care. What are they going to do, fire you? You
know? Right.
I mean, we knew damn well we're going to invent something. Someone else is going to get the credit for it.
Right.
And that's always the way it works.
Sure.
Right. And ironically, the people who did get the credit for what we did can't even describe how it was done.
Sure.
Kind of funny how that works. You know? So, and that's just the reality of hierarchy. And we were not in the hierarchy. We were
sure.
in the trench. You know, we loved the trench. And
right.
That's where you trusted the people, right? The workers, you know,
right.
were in the trench, you know.
But, you know, you got to give some credit to people. Like, for example, I would say it's undeniable that James Cameron had a vision. I would say he really understood what I would call
him, but you know where I'm going with
yeah, yeah.
it. Like Cameron was really the guy that, had it not been for his idea,
he would have
never done this stuff. The T-Rex would have never been built.
Right.
Had it not been for Terminator 2
right.
and subsequently the Abyss.
And we're going to talk about that transition because I thought that was a really cool thing, but I just while we're still on the Abyss for a second, yeah. I heard a story, possibly, and I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, and you guys would be the best to tell me, that the whole water weenie sequence was put in the movie in the way that it was edited, in case it failed, it could be cut out.
It's a true story.
It's a true story.
Yeah, Cameron he publicly says,
right.
had the sequence failed, I would have dropped it from the film.
Right.
And then I think during the talk, you know, I had said, well, you know, now we're going to sort of, the ante goes up.
Where right.
The antagonist is subsequently interlaced through the entire picture.
Right.
So it can't fail.
Right.
Right. And Cameron says that too.
Right.
Cameron's very open about that. He goes,
I mean, it is true. They tried all the traditional, they tried a lot of traditional approaches.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had done showed promise, but it had never been done. There were
right.
just a lot of doubters. So I think that was the practical reality. You're spending a lot of money on a movie, it's a big business.
Right.
You got to deal with the reality of
right.
things. And then when we came through, it was a big. It was, you know, wow.
Right.
It was a big
thing. No, it's
thing.
Very, very memorable.
Yeah,
I'm still
almost proudest of that particular thing.
Same
right.
here.
Yeah.
Same here. In terms of the animation, you know, because I animated most of the shots, and it just, there was a gentleness.
Right.
About it.
Oh, it's beautiful.
You know,
absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that transition, which is an important one, is that you the water weenie allowed you to do Terminator 2, which allowed you to do the Jurassic Park, which kind of revolutionized where CG was going to go from there on. So what was it in The Abyss that allowed for T2 and then what subsequently allowed for your test?
Okay, so basically we had with Terminator 2, we had five different types of problems, right, of
okay.
shots. So Mark and I had taken these five different types of shots of the 35 or 40 shots that were in T2
mm-hmm.
and divided them up into separate teams.
Okay.
So one team was a morph team. The other team was a death team. Right?
Okay.
And that was, and we put stock supervisors. I was animation soup on
right.
it. Mark was, you know, associate, you know, visual effects supervisor on
right.
it. So, and then we stuck these supervisors
mm-hmm.
that were responsible. One of the teams was a pseudopod team.
Okay.
Okay. Where the chrome guy you know, basically, you know, it comes through the helicopter window and stuff like that.
Right.
It's the pseudopod or comes down from the top of the elevator, but it's reflecting as opposed to refracting. Yeah,
what he means is that all the sophisticated, we wrote probably the most sophisticated shader for some time for the Abyss. Essentially, the T2, even though it looks very different, it's a very similar shading system.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it still had that one level of, ray tracing.
It had one level of ray tracing. But okay, the only difference that we really added to it is that when I built the T1000 out of the four-sided B-spline patch, is very much like a shirt.
Okay.
I'll show you pictures. I have the original, you know, and it looked like somebody had sewn a shirt together, you know.
But, right.
And we would name each one of the individual patches, and then we hired a guy out of Toronto from Alias, a guy named Angus Poon. Mm-hmm. And Angus, who is a great mathematician, wrote an algorithm, right, that stitched it together, C2 continuity, you know.
Okay.
So that seemed to work pretty well.
Okay.
You know? And then so I built the T-Rex the same way.
When we talk about that stuff, it seems so primitive compared to today's systems. That was the reality. Software was still evolving so much. It's so much more mature
today.
It was crazy, man.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, software was, you know, just figuring out how it's going to fit into this industry at that point.
There's so much sophisticated stuff now that the tools you have, and that's fantastic.
Right.
But back then, that's part of why people were they weren't believers, because they hadn't seen it.
Right.
And you couldn't show it to them. We'd have little examples, but then we had to build all this crap. And it was a challenge. T2 was a big leap forward. I mean, part of it was creating a believable humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was the fact that the water snake was a relatively simple form. I mean, there's complications to it, and putting humans' faces on the end and controlling the emotional aspect of the water waves and ripples. But T2 had so many more things. We had to define all these stages, blob to humanoid blob to detailed liquid metal human to full human.
Right.
And all of those stages were essentially separate models and separate systems. And then we had to find a way to transform between them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even when I think about it today, it worked beautifully and there were great story points in the movie that used that. Cameron really understood that completely. I remember just even today when we showed the scene of him going through the jail bars and the gun gets stuck.
Yeah.
It communicates the idea that, he's liquid metal, but the gun doesn't transform.
No, it's beautiful.
And it's really smart. Really smart.
Really brilliant writing when it comes to those little idiosyncrasies.
But what we had to do, the concept's simple, but the technology, the technique behind it was a big fucking mess.
Yeah.
And transforming the different stages.
Yeah.
And there's so many details. Like when he jumps in the helicopter and we see that guy's face reflected in the side of his helmet and the side of his face.
Yeah.
That's all purposefully done and it works beautifully.
Right.
And then when he turns around and speaks this line, I think this is the first line of a photorealistic CG digital character.
Right.
And he says, "Get out." All of those things work beautifully. They're really clear in the film. They advance the story. And each one of those things required all the special work to be done.
Yeah.
You know,
it was really cool because, you know, you had also talked about how, like, it was one of the first uses of inverse kinematics. You had to do that walk cycle of him. Am I right?
No, it was a forward kinematics.
Forward kinematics.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I love the thing that you showed because it was one of the first times I'd seen, I've very memorable moments. You know, everyone knows when he comes out of the fire pit and walks and becomes human or looks like a human, but he's got, you know, his look, and he's got a very robotic walk. And it was the first time that I actually saw the practical reference that you used exactly, where he walks exactly like that.
He walks like a machine because he was directed to walk like a machine.
And he did exactly that.
Yeah,
I thought it was a brilliant thing. First of all, you had an incredible actor that was willing to do what he was doing to help you with rotomation, right? And so you literally planted the splines on his body and had him walk down so you could get every reference.
I think he was great casting too. He
He was so into it, man.
Perfect.
Really?
We literally, because it was like invasive.
Right.
Know? Because like Mark said, he was up. We literally had him like on a crucifix.
Mm-hmm.
On a lazy Susan, spinning around, putting the grids on them,
right?
And ironically, it's so funny, all those tapes got destroyed.
Yeah.
All the real behind the scenes.
Right.
And that's another reason.
Yeah.
But, and I was like really close on him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of it, you know, people have like a personal space problem.
Yeah.
He had no issue with it whatsoever.
Yeah, well, he was professional.
It was military, mm-hmm. you know, and, so we were like, I was examining them,
mm-hmm.
essentially. I was essentially examining, because I knew I have to be, if In order to really pull this off, I have to be able to build this guy.
Right.
I have to be able to build his body. And it had never been done before.
Right.
And so we were so cocky back then.
Right.
You know, I just knew that you had to go to another, you know, being an animator, you had to go to another level of examination mm-hmm. and observation in order to replicate this natural occurrence in nature. You
know? Right.
So,
I mean, it's funny in a weird way. He's an example of the early days of a virtual character.
Yeah.
Because we tried to capture who he was. Mm-hmm. We rotoscoped his movements. Right. We captured his body shape.
And then you captured his face for the expression so that he could say his lines.
And we had quite a database of the T-1000, mm-hmm. i.e. Robert Patrick.
Right.
And we tried to capture his nature, exactly how he moved, exactly how his body form changed. That's why we had him in those little bikini shorts. You know, mm-hmm. he was very cooperative.
That I ended up with.
Yeah. Just to
It's true. I have him.
He breaks them out at the parties.
Yeah.
Look at me and my little chest.
Stripes on him. Robert was. I mean, it was essential to the process. He had to endure all this.
Right.
But really, we were capturing him as the T-1000.
Right.
And it was a lot of stuff. And
yeah.
And that was a big part of the success. It was believable because he did move like him. He did look like him. His body changed like him.
Right.
The uniform he wore, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And such memorable shots. And if you really think about it, like seeing how the Abyss turned to that makes sense and a huge step forward. But now you have yourself a believable character, complete character, as opposed to a very much more mythological, abstract character that you had from the Abyss. And then you took that and was like, I'm going to step it up a notch now. It's not going to be chrome. It's going to be fully textured, fully done. And we're going to try this thing on Jurassic Park. But before we talk about that, the story of how you guys got that. A lot of people, that changed everything. And the thing about like between Phil Tippett and Stan Winston and you guys were just scared the shit out of everyone, I'm sure, at that point, right?
They weren't scared. They were upset.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true. Part of it was, oh man, the business is changing. We're going to lose our jobs. There is that in there.
Yeah.
But I think, and that's part of it, but I think the bigger part is a lot of people just didn't believe it.
They didn't think we were capable of
right.
it. You know? Yeah. They flipped out. You know?
Right.
And I was told by Dennis Mirren, told me, he goes, I have heard a rumor that you're building the T-Rex secretly.
Right.
And that he goes, don't bother trying. There's going to be no computer graphics in this film.
Right.
That's what he told me.
Uh-huh. You did it anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, it is.
You know, I'd probably get in trouble for saying it. I'm telling you exactly what happened.
Right.
You know? I mean, it is true. They'd already invested, I assume, millions of dollars in time. They'd built full hydraulic T-Rexes with fully textured, you know, foam latex skins,
yep.
full scale. They'd already done stop motion animatics using fully built armatured representations of various characters. They'd mm-hmm. gone down this road very far.
They'd spent a lot of money
and a lot of time. And so,
and we were just supposed to add motion.
Yeah, we were brought in. We were brought in a little late because the belief was this was the answer, and they could all see the answer.
Right.
The issue was this approach limits what you can do.
Right.
Now, they had already designed a story. They'd visualized it in a certain way. And we were brought in to add blur to the stop motion. And in fact, we did do it. And I wish we had, I know I have it somewhere.
We've never shown it, have we?
But I would love to show it because it does work.
Right.
You can take a little stop motion armature guy running and we add the blurs and it fucking looks beautiful.
Right.
But still, the problem is, and there's nothing wrong with that. But
wasn't that called Go Motion or something like that?
No,
Go Motion was different.
Okay.
Go Motion is where the actual armature kind of blurs. It moves just a little bit.
The actual armature moves super slow.
And you shoot into the aperture.
And when you play it back at 24 FPS, you get free blur.
And it's fantastic. But even there, the blur is based on the specific armature set changes.
Right.
Tippett did develop that for Dragon Slayer.
Right.
And that was really the one and only time it was ever used.
Okay. And it's great.
And it worked great.
Yeah. But it has its own limitations. Now, and we added blur, and that's great. But the real reason that we were feeling this is all of these things are limiting what you can do. You can mm-hmm. only move your armatures in a certain way. How do you integrate them into a live action photography? These amazing hydraulic, and they are amazing. I still love them.
Yeah.
But they can only do certain things. Like one of my favorite examples is there was a full body T-Rex that was on a 6-ton base.
Right.
And the body could hydraulically move it's amazing, but it could not walk.
Right. So its feet couldn't leave the ground.
That's right. It couldn't move its position. It'd be lifted by a crane and set in position.
Right.
So great. When you see that in a museum or exhibition, it's fucking amazing. Moves its tail, moves its head. but it can't walk.
There's actually a really good video, and I would never show it because it's, I like, you know, Matt, you know, Stan's son and everything.
Yeah.
But there's a great video of Stan Winston that we got, right? Mm-hmm. And it's him with a Waldo, right?
With a what?
A Waldo. They call it a Waldo. In other words, it's a small truncated, small version of this massive hydraulic system.
Okay.
And he's literally, remember this?
Yeah.
He's bending, that's how you control it. He's bending the Waldo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And basically moves. It's hydraulically moving.
It's like a remote kind
it's
of.
It's like a remote control. They call it a Waldo.
Right.
At that time. Short-lived, you know, and he's literally bending this Waldo back and forth, and this, and Mirren had got the tape, right, and this fucking 9 tons of hydraulics is like this, and Stan is on camera going, they said it couldn't be done, like this. He was a showman.
Right.
So this Waldo, and it sounds terrible to say that, but that's exactly what happened. I'm just telling the truth.
I mean, yeah, but really, they are impressive, you know, given all those issues.
In terms of acting, it would have never worked.
It was limited.
You know,
they had it planned out to work, but they had to limit their shots.
Yeah.
Right.
So what we were saying is, be free, man. You can show a T-Rex running in full motion, wide shot, chasing herds. You
Eight
can have
sec, them
leaping on
shot.
Buildings.
We can do anything.
Yeah. Right. You can have dinosaurs interacting with each other. They can bite each other. They can jump on each other.
Right.
When you're doing that stuff with stop motion or animatronics, pretty damn tough.
Right.
Your shots are short.
Yeah,
right. And they're quick.
That's right.
Like
very
a second,
specific.
2 seconds.
Now you're free to have the action play out, et cetera, et cetera. So we were just like believers in this, like going, holy, we got to do this. We have to do this.
Did you see the Ampass video at the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. So where Mirren actually says, where things are going so well, mm-hmm. Spielberg said, I'm going to design a shot for the end of the film. It's not even in the script or the story.
Right.
Where you're literally on camera forever with a Rex.
Right.
And the only reason that confidence level came about is because things look so good. So you could extend the length of the actual shots in terms of seconds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas it's true, the animatronics, it would be bits. It would just be bits.
Right.
Like Alien. You're just seeing.
Right.
You know,
right. And that's the rule rule of thumb with traditional effects filmmaking.
Right.
You
get
these amazing things, but break
it
into pieces.
Let your brain fill it in.
Sure.
Right, as what the theory was.
So anyway, the big just to get back to the original question is that people didn't fucking believe it.
Right.
They really didn't. And legitimately they had doubts. I mean, you really can't say that they were wrong in a sense. But we were believers, and like we just said, damn it has to be done, and that's why we fought for it. But the same thing comes up.
We didn't
up.
Fight. We just did it secretly.
Yeah, we just did it. But we would have done it no matter what. But the point is, we had never done it. So we were, in a way, we were just like talking out of our asses.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, we knew. And I think everybody knew it was inevitable. And the question was now the time?
Right.
And we felt it's obviously the time. We'd done Abyss. We'd done T2. This is another chance for a big breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had to get a little ballsy about it and keep pushing it. And you got to give... You know, Dennis was really our mentor, Dennis Mirren. He's the effects, and we helped him win various awards. And in a lot of ways, I believe, as he said, he knew it was going to happen. But he didn't have much in-depth knowledge himself.
Sure.
He was a sponsor of mine.
Yeah, he was the front guy.
You got to give him credit for sponsoring us.
If he went on a limb, the only reason the whole Rex stuff happened the way it did is mm-hmm. because I knew darn well, right, that we weren't going to be, even if I said, guess what, man, I'm going to be on the company dole, you know, and you guys are going to pay me, I'm going to go secretly build a T-Rex,
right?
So what Mark and I did, Mark was directing a commercial, right?
Yeah. In Japan, right?
In Japan. And I was officially animating on it,
right.
but I was not.
Right.
I did a little bit of animation on it, but I was secretly building the Rex bones,
mm-hmm.
right, is what happened. Right, because I knew, and then that's when, you know, he told me, he literally said, because his buddy, Phil, had all the work,
mm-hmm.
right, and said, I've heard, you know, a rumor you're building the T-Rex, don't bother trying.
Right.
Right, because there's going to be no CG in this film.
Right.
Right, which is really fascinating to me in a way, but there was no negating it after, you know, Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall saw that test,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they saw it, and then the ball got rolling.
Yeah.
You
know? But I mean, I think... You know, Dennis and Phil had worked together for years. Phil was actually the creature wizard.
Right.
I think he was the leader of, and I'm sure they'd already gone through stuff like, no. You know, the organic nature of physical animatronics, physical puppets,
mm-hmm.
physical stop motion was the answer. Forget And I'm sure it was brought up. We weren't there. We were kept out of those conversations, and they were not part of them. And so they'd already gone down this path. And I think, you know, Dennis was kind of like having to deal with the not only the reality of what he can guarantee, but the political reality of what was going on.
Yeah.
To say yes to us was to say no to all the stuff they'd already gone far down the road with.
Yeah, right. and that's what he was really.
It was a big deal, and in the end, he was with us. Like, we're doing it CG, and
of course
it's like
he was with us.
Poor Phil. I mean, you know, Phil had it was a tough road
Phil
for that
is,
guy.
Phil is all CG now and doesn't
yeah,
work. But
at and that
Phil,
point,
and
it was
you know,
tough.
It's so funny because Phil said, you know, because what happened was that we had to. Janet Healy attempted to try and drag Randy Dutra, you know, and Tom Santamon, who are Phil's animators, mm-hmm. into our shop.
So right.
It's being done. And Phil goes, no, I want to keep an individual shop.
Right.
So we had to build this device. A guy named Craig, I can't remember his last name, that worked for yes. Tippett. He was an engineer. Anyways, we had to build this armature system with potentiometers along it. Mm-hmm. The potentiometers plugged into an R232 SCSI port in the back of SGI Indigo, mm-hmm. 340.
Okay.
And so what would happen is that in SI, they would bend the character, store the frame, bend the character, store the frame. Mm-hmm. And the funniest thing in the world, it was called the DID.
Okay.
We called it the didn't because it didn't work. Right. So, but even Dutcher and Santamon say, you know, when Phil's not around, man, we just do it on fives and tens and stuff like that and let SI in between for free because right. we would get the data and it'd be all spiked up. We have to run a smoothing algorithm
right.
on the data. It never really worked. And you couldn't get it small enough for the Hawks or the Rex.
Right.
Right. So they would only really realistically be able to handle like the major joints.
Okay.
You know, because the potentiometers could not measure.
There were technical limitations. The potentiometers were noisy. I mean, it's just all these things have their own issues.
But ironically, they say, oh, yeah, well, you know, ILM doesn't have any character animator. They can't. No. I personally built all the running shots of the T-Rex, and that came from nowhere.
Right.
From Tippett Studio.
Right, right, right.
You know, nowhere.
Yeah. You know? Well, it was history, and I think, obviously, it was the turning point for probably a large portion of the people that got into visual effects around my age, which is not young, right? Right? I'm 45, so like that's not young. And I remember seeing that. I just graduated from college and I was going to grad school for architecture and I was getting into architectural visualization. That's when it kind of started my career. And I was like, all right. And then I'm sitting in front of an SGI at this point. I'm like trying to figure out how to do ArcViz on an SGI and doing all kinds of stuff. But that movie was an important part to a lot of people. And like, and I think someone even said in the office, thank you for my youth, you know.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah, yeah, I heard that, yeah.
And so that was a really great thing. And I think you guys did a beautiful thing. But what's interesting to me, if you think about the controversy that you guys presented in that movie, which I think was a big one, and we all like feel like, well, we all won in the end, which is good. That controversy still exists today more mm-hmm. than ever mm-hmm. and in a disappointing way in my mind. Mm-hmm. One of the threads I've been doing on my podcast here and there is I'm starting doing this hashtag called Respect VFX, you know, because I think that everyone's like, oh, it's all CG now. It was much better when it was all practical. And I think there's a little bit of BS in that statement because really people will look at Jurassic Park and talk about why it was better than Jurassic World because
we just gave a big talk on that very controversy.
I know. And here's my thoughts, Matt. I actually think that the best part of Jurassic Worlds are the dinosaurs. The worst part is the fact it's a crap story.
Right. And I think that reflects, but that reflects people's attitude.
But there's like, they're like, the reason it's crap is it's all CG. And it's like, no, that's the best part of it. And if you go back to Jurassic Park, it's a fantastic story. But the CG and the practical, or the CG is so good that you don't know which one is which. Right. So that's actually, I don't know. I just think that there's something to be said about it. So what are your thoughts today about how people are doing, especially popular press? Popular press loves to bash CG mm-hmm. these days. What do you think your thoughts are on that?
You know, I think Jurassic Park 2, something you said that strikes me is it was a great combination of using everything for what it's best at. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of physical effects in that movie. I think we mentioned it earlier. One of the things I remember so well is the battering head. There's a physical T-Rex head, latex covered, animatronically controlled, hydraulically controlled, mm-hmm. full scale T-Rex head on a crane arm mm-hmm. that could like come into frame and like sniff at the kids in the car.
Right.
It could bash the car, and it was so effective. So
yeah.
Do it that way.
Of course.
Don't do it with CG.
Yeah.
Now, today...
You didn't have the computer power to deal with the physics of smashing into a car.
It would be very costly. See, nowadays, it's like you can do everything CG. Yes, you can. But then you lose... So there's certain things... You know, like to me, another thing I would say is God's the biggest computer in the world. Look out at nature and the light on the water. Sure. That's like the most amazing computation there is. So if you can take advantage of that, that's why people shoot background plates still.
Right.
There's something... there's an amazing reality, you can call it computation, whatever, that is here. So whenever you can do that... Do it.
Right.
I mean, another mantra we used on Jurassic Park, which I still believe in, is shoot what you're shooting and put everything you can in there that looks great. And then you take out what shouldn't be there and add what's missing.
Right.
So, but you do want to put as much as you can there. There's something about the touch of reality, the interaction of reality, the physicality of reality
right.
that is wonderful. And you shouldn't just eliminate it just because you can. So there's, and I think nowadays it's a little facile. Like,
right.
Oh man, we can just do that. Well, you have to really remember what you're missing by not having something for the actors to react to.
Right.
For not having something that's actually affecting the environment that they're in.
Right.
And sometimes I think some big shows that mm-hmm. we all know about, it's amazing what they're doing, but there's something that rings false, that rings artificial,
right?
It reveals itself too much in its amazingness.
Do you think it's more instead of less? Well, I'm trying to find other words for it to describe it better. That's usually a better thing. Do you think that these movies are more about the spectacle instead of complementing the story in a lot of ways?
I think that happens too.
I think a lot of them are kind of promotional pamphlets for video games. I mean, video game industry is so big now.
Right.
It's kind of like you can dress up a hamburger, but it's still a hamburger. You know? It's like unfortunately there's a little bit of that goes on.
Right.
Know? So I think they use a lot of these films that they have to have like sort of there has to be a unification between the film gets released, the video game comes out, you know, and so the video game has to basically reflect, you know, the fact there is no real story in a video game.
Right.
Per se. You know, so, you know, like the film like Pacific Rim, you know, what a piece of crap, you know. So, you know, the visual effects are so good at it. You know? Oh, it's horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jurassic World, that whole film was shot on digital, probably an Arri Alexa.
Right.
Now, we're shooting photochemical.
Right.
And compositing computer graphics on photochemical, adding grain, you know.
So you're doing optical printing compositing?
Well, no, we're actually doing digital
compositing. Oh, you were? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Abyss was the only one that we did optical with computer graphics.
That's kind of a cool note. I'm sorry, but.
that was because the technology of scanning film and outputting film was still complicated. Yeah.
T2 was the first thing we did all digital comp. You know,
wow. And then print that film digitally, I guess.
Hunt for Red October. We worked on Hunt for Red October as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We used actually all the little vortex trails behind the torpedoes and the actual submarines are all little pseudopods.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a tweak shader. It's true. It's funny how you can that technology was used a lot.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, it's true. You know, look, and I think it's just a matter of degree because the same thing occurred years ago before computer graphics.
Right.
You can still look at even old movies that had that problem. I just think today you can in principle almost do anything with a computer in a sense visually. So it just becomes too facile. I think it's just a crutch a little bit sometimes. But it still can be great. It can still do wonderful things. There are movies that are effects heavy that are amazing.
Right.
So it's not the fault. You know, VFX are blameless.
Right.
It's really just how you use them in the service of the story and the movie you make.
Right.
So I do feel that occasionally it's overblown, but that's true whether or not there are visual effects, to be honest.
Sure.
I don't think it's the fault of visual effects, yeah.
Sure. All right. I want to, I have two questions, but the first one is there was a really interesting question that someone asked at the end. It was, and he asked about, you know, the idea that you guys were pioneers, right? You're pioneers at this time. And today, as you said, now there's a lot of tools that do this stuff, right? So now the people doing it are doing fantastic work, really, really great work, but they're not inventing as much as you guys were inventing. So would you still do it today the same way? If you were starting today, would it be, what would you still do it? Or you say, no, I want to do something that if no one's ever done.
If we were challenged with that type of thing?
Or do you?
Well,
do,
it's about a challenge. You know, whatever the challenge is, you know, you find the tool in order to succeed.
Right.
With a challenge, right? So it's kind of a theoretical question. You
right.
know? Yeah, you know. So, you know, what's the new challenge?
What is the new challenge?
Well, it's digital humans. It'll happen whether people like it or not. You know, we always talked about this, and it will happen. And
well, you know, I don't know if you don't notice, but this is a huge part of what I'm doing. It's digital human work. I have a website. Part of the research I'm doing in my company is something called WikiHuman. We're open sourcing a digital human and well, giving out that data.
It's like I said in the talk, I mean, you know, human eyes sees 13.3 million colors.
Yeah.
You know, whether, you know, it's LED, LCD, any form of display, you know, it's still a bathtub of color ball bearings. It's really right. it's just a matter of time, whether anyone likes to hear it or not.
Right.
It's a fact, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't believe us when we said we were going to build a T-Rex.
Right.
Even the experts said we were wrong.
Right, yeah.
You know, the same guys who got the award.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, there's lots of things I think that are exciting still. You know, I like some of the ideas of things like AR, and I even like the experimentation with what Jurassic Park was insinuating, you know, DNA manipulation to bring things alive from the past.
Sure.
There's lots of things that excite me about technology. But just fundamentally, the whole idea of simulating the world as we know it, life as we know it, and on top of that, creating things that don't exist that we can only imagine, that process is still growing. Like, for example, people talk about things like, you know, 3D cameras or 360 cameras that can capture everything. Mm-hmm. And then you can go in and experience it. Well, of course, there's physical limitations because most systems capture from a single point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't capture all the... If you walk around to the other side of the building that wasn't photographed, you can't see it.
Right.
Now, in a weird way to me, what that's really asking as a question is forget all these bizarre, these complicated data-heavy systems that are capturing, you know, all of the data from all angles from a fixed system. And, oh, maybe we'll do 10 of them and interpolate. Eventually, it's begging the question of just simulating the world.
Right.
And then you walk around in this real simulation of the real world. And I think that is coming.
And do you ever hear the story that the closer we are to simulating the world, the closer the truth is that we are actually living in a simulation?
Yeah. Listen, I love that stuff. The whole question of why do we know we're real? Why do we know we exist?
It's a fact. Yeah, we're living in a simulation now, man. I mean, you know, we only have five senses and they're all fallible.
Yeah,
so all we're trying to do is replicate ourselves synthetically.
Right.
But I mean, it's a deep question. Our perception of what the world is reduced by not only our physical perceptions, but our mental state.
Right.
I mean, it's a big, big, I love that idea.
Yeah.
And in fact, and this notion of being able to simulate the reality is more than we can perceive.
Right.
It's a big, big, and I think that's really where we're headed. I mean, this relates to even ideas like the singularity. You know, we're getting the. You know, I mentioned something today which I was kind of serious about, which is today you have these systems like the computer that beat the Go world champion.
Right, right, right.
Big Blue.
20 years ago, that was this posited question that was impossible.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that
right.
because computers are all about combinatorial solutions.
Right.
So, hey, it's over. The Google image search system. You can just think of all these things that even 10 years ago were beyond our ken.
Right.
And now they're working. And eventually the computers will know so much they can simulate our world. They'll know so much if we talk about the kind of story we want to create, they'll write the script for us and we'll make the movie. I mean, there's a bizarre reality to that.
Right.
And we're heading to this point where that understanding or recreating human experience is viable.
Right.
It's a bizarre thing to think about.
There was another fascinating thing about specifically artificial intelligence, which I think is also interesting, is that some of the challenges out there are, for example, it's easier, quote unquote, to make a computer that can beat a chess champion than it is to make a robot that can make a cup of tea in someone else's kitchen.
Yeah. It is amazing. Or to decide what to wear to a birthday party.
Right.
I mean, it's bizarre. But we're approaching those things because even though they become more abstract, there is my feeling about it Is there a way to, there is a way to understand it, to break it down.
Right.
And we're getting closer and closer, man. It's unbelievable. And that, those things are all exciting to me.
Yeah.
And they're all exciting to me in the context of storytelling and movement, making movies, you know?
Cool. Well, I want to know what you guys are up to next. Can you say anything about what your next big things and why you guys are still hanging out after, what is it, 25 plus years?
That's a good question.
28.
Yeah. 28 years.
I'm working with Jamie from Mythbusters.
I love Jamie.
On a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm working for M5.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm having a lot of fun. I'm sort of back to what I used to know, welding and fabricating and stuff like that. So working with my hands a lot.
Nice.
Yeah. You know.
I can come to the parties, basically. Yeah. No, I haven't seen Jamie in a long time. But I know they're doing some cool things. I'm still working in visual effects and filmmaking, doing a project which I can't really talk about. Right. But I'm also investigating these new ways of making visual stories, you know, using AR and stuff. So I'm a gearhead a little bit. So I'm always checking out all the new stuff. You know, I think I'm gonna start getting my own little CRISPR system and start manufacturing my own bacteria.
That's on
my list.
Yeah. I think you really should.
And I'm gonna infect you, man.
Yeah, to pay back to
genetic alteration.
Yeah. All right. Well, what we do at the end is we actually do Polaroids of all of our guys, which has been great. And so we'll do a Polaroid picture. But I actually have a question that one of you guys may be able to answer. So this is a story that happened to me at the airport, right? I take this film, which is Polaroid film, which they don't make anymore. So this is someone that makes a version of Polaroid film.
Right.
And it takes 30 minutes to develop as opposed to 30 seconds. And
really?
It's, yeah.
Cool.
But every time I've gone through the airport and then do podcasts and I travel all over the place, the film gets ruined by the X-ray. You know, slowly. Right. Like every time it goes through the X-ray machine, it fades.
It's not uncommon.
So I always say I take it out of the bag and I have it hand checked, right? So I was going through Frankfurt and I had to go back through security and I had it hand checked. And so I said, all right, can you please manually check the, you know, and it's like, no problem. We'll, you know, they did a little bomb sniffer. Well, they tested the camera and three rolls. I have five rolls of film. So three rolls of films were fine. And the last two tested positive for explosive.
No kidding.
Really?
Yeah. So
what kind of explosive?
They wouldn't say. But then they had to flag me and they had to call the cops and they had to ask me for my flight information and stuff like that. And
highly suspicious.
And I explained to them, I was like, listen, I volunteered to have it checked by you guys. And they're like, yeah. And she was looking, it's like, that's weird. It's like, I got it on Amazon.
Well, there could be an accelerant in it. You know, and the accelerant could have been construed as being an explosive.
Yeah, I guess so. But it had me nervous because, like, I don't know.
Anyway, that'd be a whole other angle. Some weirdo selling stuff on Amazon.
Well, I doubt there's like tritium in it or anything like that, or C4.
Right. Yeah, but it's interesting. I guess there's some kind of chemical in there that could be construed.
Yeah, it could be used as an accelerant, and that's what they say. Oh, it's an explosive. No, it's an accelerant for an explosive, like sulfur or potassium nitrate.
Right.
Something like that.
So.
Great sub story.
Yeah.
All right. Well, cool. I appreciate it so much, guys. Sure, I usually say that I'm going to let the last bucket drop because we have a ray tracer that has little buckets. But we're actually not doing buckets much anymore. We're doing progressive rendering now. It's an old school saying. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it.
It was great,
Chris.
I was talking with you.
All right.